Lecture 19, Franklin, Autobiography.
In the lectures on Rousseau, we've been moving away from the mainstream Enlightenment with its optimism, practicality, sociability. And in the final four lectures, we'll see it questioned very profoundly from two different points of view. In the disturbingly skeptical novel Les Liaisons Dangereuses by Chaudelot de Laclos, and lastly in the magnificently original imaginative vision of the poet-painter William Blake, who will be our guide as we make the big turn into the movement known as Romanticism. But cultural history isn't monolithic, and before we arrive at Laclos and Blake, we need to return to the mainstream Enlightenment. The empiricist values it promoted work very well indeed for a lot of people, and they've gone on working well in many ways ever since. In most of the texts that we've been reading, we've privileged self-analysis, a concern with inwardness, a tendency to self-doubt or self-critique. Literary theory is particularly fond of what's been called the hermeneutics of suspicion, after the model of Freud. The term hermeneutics used to mean biblical interpretation, often concerned with uncovering hidden allegorical meanings. Now it's been extended to interpretation of texts generally, and even self-interpretation, as if our own selves were riddling texts to be decoded. In psychoanalytic thought, this has meant searching for repressed motives hidden in the mysterious unconscious. In contrast to literary studies, academic psychology has been more concerned with experiments involving people in groups, closer really to sociology than to psychoanalysis. And I would argue that, in fact, for most people in our culture, the other-directed, pragmatic, empiricist model is still the one we live by, though with a controlled mixture of psychotherapy added in. One of the old light bulb jokes went, "How many psychiatrists does it take to change a light bulb?" And the answer was, "Only one, but the light bulb has to really want to change." Well, Benjamin Franklin is that light bulb. He's a standing challenge to the tradition of suspicious self-analysis. Franklin deliberately shaped himself as if he were the subject of his own behaviorist experiment. And as far as anyone can tell, it worked extremely well. And that's why we're meeting him at this point in the course. Franklin's autobiography has been highly influential, but unlike Rousseau's confessions, it's resolutely other-directed. And it's often been accused of being morally and psychologically shallow. I don't think it's shallow at all. Franklin has very good reasons for handling his story the way he does, leaving out or minimizing the kinds of things Rousseau would have emphasized. And just an aside on chronology, by the way, it would be wrong to suppose that Franklin should have learned from reading Rousseau's confessions. The confessions weren't published till 1782, and that was 10 years after Franklin wrote the first part of his autobiography, which, of course, is the part describing his early life. In fact, the autobiography didn't even get that title until the middle of the 19th century, because autobiography was a brand new word that got invented when people realized a new form had come into existence, a true biography written by oneself. Up until then, the usual term was memoirs, which implies something much less focused and analytical than autobiography. Well, the image that Franklin gives is of a remarkably unconflicted person. And I want to start by saying it makes a lot of sense. Here's an impressive comment by a historian named Carl Becker 70 years ago. "Great men are often hampered by some inner discord or want of harmony with the world in which they live. It was Franklin's good fortune to have been endowed with a rare combination of rare qualities, and to have lived at a time when circumstances favored the development of all his powers to the fullest extent." Well, inner discord and want of harmony with the social world would describe Jean-Jacques Rousseau very well. To a lesser extent, it could describe quite a few other writers we've been considering in this course. Franklin was the opposite kind of person in every way. He was well-adjusted. He was gregarious. He loved to interact with other people. He enjoyed life immensely. We could say the same thing about Hume or Diderot, but here's another point. Everyone we've read so far in this course, without exception, was a writer, first and foremost, not Franklin. He certainly was a very accomplished writer, but above all, he was a public figure. And by the time he began his autobiography, or memoirs, in 1771, he was 65. He'd been a leading public figure for a very long time. At that point, he was living in England, where for 14 years he'd been the colonial representative for Pennsylvania. He was working hard to reconcile the colonies with Britain. They were drifting dangerously apart. He wasn't arguing for independence. He was trying to get Parliament to take greater responsibility for Pennsylvania, which suffered from an interesting and peculiar historical origin. King Charles II in the 17th century owed a large debt to William Penn's father, an admiral also called William Penn. And because the king was broke, he gave him instead a huge tract of land that nobody wanted west of New Jersey. It was going to be called Sylvania, so they made it Pennsylvania. And from then on, the Penn family were known as the proprietors. They lived in England. They took no interest in Pennsylvania, except as a cash cow. And that's what Franklin's trying to do something about. The image of Franklin is very well established in our minds. He's the kindliest and wittiest of the founding fathers. He's the only one we know by his nickname. We don't say Tom Jefferson or Jim Madison. We remember him as he wanted to be remembered, a tireless inventor and a tireless organizer. He lives in a world of people and activity and projects and public works, founding fire departments and post offices and public libraries and the University of Pennsylvania, inventing the Franklin stove, inventing the lightning rod, inventing bifocal glasses, and so on. Franklin was a spokesman for sincerity, by which he meant uprightness and truth-telling in business and in politics as in life. And he famously said in Poor Richard's Almanac, "Honesty is the best policy." We usually stress best, but we should stress policy. It pays off well. He knows people are unenthusiastic about being honest if you tell them it's their unpleasant moral duty. He wants to persuade them honest people, by gaining other people's trust, end up more successful. They do well by doing good. So the idea is an honest businessman will get much richer than a dishonest businessman. We certainly all hope that's true. What we surprisingly don't know about Franklin, in spite of his very high visibility and his gregarious personality, is who he really was inside. He kept his personal life pretty much hidden. People who study him get the sense that he was a man of personas in a way that we're distrustful of today. One modern scholar says he was full of blarney. Another one speaks of his bottomless box of masks. But if they are masks, they fit his face comfortably, even if he never actually lets us see the face. A great scholar, Edmund Morgan, who has scrutinized every word in the 50 volumes of Franklin's collected papers and everything anyone ever said about him, Morgan says bluntly, "Who can do more than guess about this man?" Well, it's interesting that, like Boswell, Franklin, as a young man, modeled his writing on the spectator. He was developing a tone of amused, tolerant detachment, as the name spectator suggests. For him, writing wasn't expressivist or confessional, as it was for Rousseau. It was a craft, like swimming. He used to give lessons in swimming when he was in England as a young man. As Franklin saw it, his task in this autobiography was to paint an accurate portrait of an Enlightenment public figure, not at all to explore inner experience. And masks or not, he became a national icon because he was so obviously unphony. Even in the midst of his public service, there's always an attractive sense of ironic detachment, very different from the self-promotion of most politicians then and now. It was an old legend, they wouldn't let him write the Declaration of Independence because he might have concealed a joke in it. And it's been argued by historians of culture that America in particular has developed the idea that a sense of humor is something everybody ought to have. Maybe it's a way of reconciling us to social conformity, helping us to fit in even while respecting our own individuality. We're taught to laugh at ourselves, but with others. It's a perfect description of Franklin's self-presentation, but it's the exact opposite of what laughter used to mean in the old humor theory. We saw it in Hobbes. In Hobbes, you laugh at other people because you feel superior to them. And we think about it, the evolution of the word humor reflects exactly the same increase in subjectivity that we've been tracing all along in this course. Originally, a humor was a physical imbalance that produced eccentric or deformed behavior. So it was an objective fact about a person who had too much phlegm or black bile. Now it becomes subjective. It's a positive quality in a person who has a sense of humor, tolerant, playful, able to see the amusing side of things. I think Franklin's conception of politics reflects exactly this kind of personality. He wasn't an ideologue. He wasn't a prophet. He was committed to politics not as high theory, such as we associate with phrases like, we hold these truths to be self-evident or inalienable rights. For Franklin, politics was compromise, interest groups negotiating and competing, everything Rousseau's general will was supposed to prevent. It's politics as the art of the possible. Franklin wasn't so much a leader as a facilitator. And psychologically, he embodies the ideal of being well-adjusted, and he embodies it very consciously. In the life story that he tells us, he finds a way to turn every setback around. You can see what I'm driving at. It's all too likely that in a course like this one, we'll demote a person like Franklin and stand in judgment over him. But I've tried to emphasize all along there are many models of the self. Rousseau represents the auto-critique of the Enlightenment, exposing some of its weaknesses. Franklin represents the positive achievement of the Enlightenment, embodying its strengths. He was very much an empiricist at heart. He believed in learning from experience, and indeed from experimentalism. He got international fame for his important discoveries in electricity, and they were possible because he rejected dogmatic theories that the so-called experts of the time were hampered by. And modern historians of science tell us he wasn't just a hobbyist with a kite and a key. He really made major discoveries about electricity at a time when it was very little understood. In addition, he was very much an Enlightenment thinker in emphasizing practical usefulness. He wasn't interested in science as pure theory, or for what it might be able to do to make our lives better. Rousseau wanted to get rid of as many modern luxuries as possible. Franklin would have been delighted with microwave ovens and DVD players and cell phones for all. Besides that, he was very conscious of his approach to life as representative of the new nation that was being born. This was the Enlightenment in the wide open field of America, as contrasted with the tradition-ridden cultures of Europe. And indeed, Franklin constantly presents himself as the representative American, whereas philosophers like Voltaire prided themselves on being universal citizens of the world. Throughout his life, what Franklin genuinely liked was to merge himself in a group identity. First, there were little clubs of like-minded friends. Later on, the projects for Philadelphia, eventually the whole of America. And it makes sense to say his strongest feelings were evoked by his public role, contrary to what we usually assume about people. So, there's an introduction to the public persona that Franklin achieved and was proud of achieving. What kind of life story does he tell in support of that persona? The autobiography begins with the words, "Dear son," as if it's a private communication within his own family, and we outsiders are privileged to see it. As it happens, there's more here than meets the eye. This son of his, William, whom he called Billy, was illegitimate. He was born a year before Franklin got married to his wife, Deborah. There's no mention at all of that in the autobiography, and no one's ever found out who the mother was. Moreover, this Billy was 40 years old when Franklin started to write the autobiography, not the youth needing instruction that the opening might suggest. In fact, by then he was governor of New Jersey. And the sequel was unfortunate, too. When the American Revolution came 5 years after that, they broke with each other bitterly. William, the son, stayed loyal to his British patrons. Franklin took that as a personal betrayal. There's nothing about that either in the autobiography. Here's another point of interest right at the beginning. Franklin dates this presumed letter to his son like this: Twyford at the Bishop of St. Asaph's, 1771. This is when he's living in London as the Pennsylvania representative there. So he makes us understand he's sitting down to write in a comfortable country estate as the guest of an important man. And even more important, he must clearly have pleasant social relations with a bishop in the Anglican Church, which shows he's a tolerant live-and-let-live type. Rousseau's books were burned by official government order, and were denounced by the Catholic Church and the Calvinist ministers. Franklin was very much a skeptic in the Enlightenment tradition, but he doesn't make waves. So now he gets ready to narrate his life. And whereas Rousseau emphasized his suffering and shame, he tells us we'll groan at his disgraceful actions, Franklin clearly feels good about his life. He says, "Were it offered to my choice, I should have no objection to a repetition of the same life from its beginning, only asking the advantages authors have in a second edition to correct some faults of the first." That's a printer's little joke, but it speaks to a real truth about Franklin's self-understanding. Not only is life good on the whole, but any faults or errors that do creep in are correctable. That's a point we'll come back to and look at more closely in the next lecture. Rousseau reads the text of his own life to locate permanent wrong turnings. Franklin sees it not as a permanent text, but a revisable project, and he wouldn't find it hard to straighten out the loose ends if he ever got the chance to publish a second edition. All in all, Franklin is a perfect type of the self-made man. As a boy in Boston, he showed great intellectual promise, but was taken out of school because the family had no money and he had to learn a trade. They apprenticed him to an older brother of his who was a printer, and as it happens, they got along very badly. So at the age of 17, Franklin did exactly what Rousseau did at 16. He ran away from his native town and made his way all alone to far-off Philadelphia. But there the similarities stop. Unlike Rousseau, who had no marketable skills, Franklin was already a highly skilled craftsman. He even had a good deal of experience at running the business by himself when his brother had been away. And he had already made himself into an accomplished writer. He'd been contributing anonymous satiric pieces to a newspaper his brother published. Brother never suspected that the writer was his own kid brother. While modern interpreters have tried, for example, to figure out Franklin's probably conflicted feelings about his parents, there's no way he'll ever tell us. The sole point he makes about his father in the autobiography is that important people in Boston came to him for advice, something a humble tallow chandler, a maker of candles and soap, could never have expected in hierarchical England. One fact does seem clearly relevant to a modern interpreter, though Franklin doesn't comment on it. There were a lot of siblings older than he was. He was the youngest son among 17 children by two different mothers, and as the youngest, he had to learn to get along. But also, he was the youngest son of the youngest son for five generations back, and he seems to have felt specially favored. In fact, he was the only one for whom education was seriously considered. It seems almost like a charmed destiny, the hero of a fairy tale. So he got to Philadelphia, and he systematically shaped himself into a particular kind of person, and in ways we'll be thinking about from various perspectives. If you look sometime at the many portraits of Franklin that were painted during his life, they trace a clear progression in his symbolic self-presentation. As he advances in the world, there's increasing signs of success. He's wearing more expensive clothes, he has a grander wig, and also a consistent iconography of Franklin the scientist develops. There'll be books of science on the table or in his hand, and through the window, you'll see a lightning bolt. But toward the end, he decided to simplify his image. For example, in a very well-known portrait by Charles Wilson Peale, it's on the cover of the Penguin edition of the autobiography, if you happen to get that edition. Peale strove to capture the human reality of the great men of the Revolution, whereas Gilbert Stuart idealized them. And in that portrait, Franklin is 79 years old, wearing the bifocals that he'd invented, and also wearing his own hair, as they used to say in those days, that is, not wearing a wig. Well, when he was in Paris as a kind of American ambassador, people were impressed by the simplicity of letting his stringy hair show. He didn't hide his increasing baldness. When he had to keep warm in the winter, he wore a beaver hat. Again, the iconography of the simple democratic American. Doesn't have to impress people anymore with his clothes and his wig. But along with that kind of image, there was another, in those days, very well-known one, which went along with the ideology of the Enlightenment. It was a widely reproduced engraving that showed a heroic Franklin up in the sky wearing swirling robes like some kind of classical god. And the caption underneath it was a Latin phrase written in Franklin's honor by a philosopher whose name was Turgot. In Latin, it was, "Eripperit coelo fulmen sceptrumque tyrannis," which would mean he sees lightning from the sky and the scepter from the tyrant. So seen in this light, Franklin is an ideal representative of the Enlightenment. His discoveries about electricity promise to have immense value for human life, and his resistance to royal tyranny set an example of collective action that could bring about lasting political improvement. Well, I spent a lot of time on Franklin's image because that is so totally the point of his autobiography. Let's come back now to his boyhood, where the parallels with Rousseau are well worth further reflection. Franklin, just like Rousseau, devoured Plutarch's Lives. But whereas what Rousseau learned from Plutarch was the days of greatness are long gone, Franklin saw no reason not to become a public hero himself one day. Again, like Rousseau, his experience as an apprentice gave him a lifelong resentment of maltreatment by employers. There's a footnote in his autobiography where he says about the brother from whom he ran away, "I fancy his harsh and tyrannical treatment of me might be a means of impressing me with that aversion to arbitrary power that has stuck to me through my whole life." But Franklin is not interested, as Rousseau is, in the inner life of the boy, or the ways in which the experience of servitude could socialize him into profoundly inauthentic behavior. Listen to this brilliant passage from Rousseau's Confessions. He describes what happened when he began pilfering apples and other little things from his master, who would find out and give him a terrible beating for it. And he says, "After enduring plenty of beatings, I became less sensitive, and in the end, it seemed to me a kind of compensation for theft that gave me the right to keep on stealing. I decided that beating me like a rascal gave me the right to be one. I found out that to steal and to be beaten went together. If I fulfilled my part of the bargain, I could leave it to my master to take care of his." Franklin doesn't indulge in any reflections of this kind, and I doubt if he had any. Rousseau sees himself permanently altered by this symbiotic relationship between brutal master and dishonest employee, giving him habits that persisted long after he escaped Geneva and worked as a servant elsewhere. Franklin just makes up his mind to oppose tyranny wherever he encounters it, leaves town, starts a new life, becomes an absolute watchword for uprightness and honesty. So in Rousseau's case, injustice got internalized in complicated, self-destructive ways. Franklin isn't interested in what gets internalized. Actually, there is an episode involving stealing in Franklin's autobiography. He says, "I was generally a leader among the boys and sometimes led them into scrapes." Well, here's the specific scrape he recalls. He and some other kids wanted to build themselves a little wharf to stand on when they went fishing on the banks of the Charles River in Boston. And they helped themselves to a pile of stones they found, which actually were intended for a house that was about to be built. And the workmen found out and told their parents. Franklin's father convinced him, he says, "Nothing was useful which was not honest." How different that is from Rousseau stealing apples from his master and being thrashed for it, let alone the disturbing story of stealing the ribbon and blaming poor Marion for it. As Franklin tells it, the anecdote illustrates two things. He was always a natural leader. He just had to learn to channel it appropriately. And also, right at the outset, he gets a good solid piece of poor Richard's worldly wisdom. Nothing is useful that is not honest. And even more than that, he shows us he can learn from his mistakes. Whereas what Rousseau shows is our mistakes form a pattern. They reveal aspects of ourselves that are very hard to change. Now, does this mean Franklin is shallow and Rousseau is deep? Not at all. It means Franklin has a completely different idea of what's relevant for an autobiography and what the reader has a right to know. Rousseau challenged the reader on page one of the Confessions to be as honest and self-critical as he was. Remember, he said, "Let each one reveal his heart with the same sincerity at the foot of God's throne and then say, I was better than that man." Franklin is portraying his public self as a very different kind of example for us all. An example not how to expose our inconsistencies and self-deceptions, but how to minimize them, how to shape our lives in a positive way. Right at the start, he admits he has plenty of vanity, but just like Hume and the philosophe, he sees it as a good thing. You have to believe in yourself in order to accomplish anything. Most people, he says, dislike vanity in others, whatever share they have of it themselves, but I give it fair quarter wherever I meet with it, being persuaded it's often productive of good. And therefore, in many cases, it would not be absurd if a man were to thank God for his vanity, among the other comforts of life. Rousseau looks back at childhood and explores it in amazing depth to understand how he became the man who found civilization fatally flawed. Franklin looks back at childhood very briefly to understand how he became the man who could get other people to work together constructively for a common cause, and not least by believing in himself. His autobiography did have that effect for many, many readers over at least the next century. There was a man named Jared Sparks, who was born in 1789, eventually became the editor of Franklin's papers, also Washington's, became president of Harvard, too. Sparks read Franklin's autobiography when he was a Connecticut farm boy, and he says, "It taught me that circumstances do not have a sovereign control over the mind." If you think about the social milieu that Franklin came from, he was raised in Boston at just the time when it was transitioning from Puritan to Yankee. His father was a member of Cotton Mather's congregation. That was the last of the sin and damnation preachers. But Franklin read a book by Mather called An Essay to Do Good, and he read it in a totally secular, pragmatic way. Mather was talking about the uselessness of good works for salvation. Franklin is just interested in good works. Let salvation take care of itself. Similarly, he liked the Pilgrim's Progress, but he read it for narrative technique and dialogue, not the message. You could say he was the master of therapy for adult children of Calvinists. Now, this is the right time to say something about the famous Weber thesis, named after the great German sociologist Max Weber. He wrote a book called The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism. And he argues there was a close connection between Protestant attitudes toward work and the emergence of capitalism in Northern Europe. Historians have endlessly debated whether really there was a cause and effect connection or not, but just leave that aside. Weber makes a very convincing case for the relevance of certain Protestant attitudes in the development of modern commercial society. One of these is the secularization of the calling, which is what the word vocation means in Latin. In the Catholic tradition, only monks and nuns and priests had a vocation, but the leaders of the Reformation, Luther and Calvin, refused to separate the sacred from the secular like that. They held all work is done in God's service. It was what they called the priesthood of all believers. And that implied that laboring diligently, so that indeed you get ahead in the world, could be a sign that God approves of you. A second point, however, it becomes a bad sign if you spend your money too freely and indulge too much in pleasure. And Weber coined the phrase worldly asceticism for this new ethic. Entrepreneurs and speculators tried to get as rich as they possibly could, but went on living a simple life in which frugality became a moral virtue. One more aspect of the Weber thesis: the capitalist is committed to rational calculation, has to have a willingness to defer rewards. He's acquisitive, but he also has plenty of self-discipline. There are a lot of quotations from Benjamin Franklin in Weber's book, because Franklin certainly did preach those values. But in his own life, he wasn't a simple example of it. He retired at the age of 42 in order to live as a gentleman of leisure with intellectual and philanthropic interests. He even refused to ever take out patents for his many inventions. He wasn't trying to get rich. He wanted them to be common property for everyone. But he did certainly see disciplined labor as a sign of personal worth. And of course, that's at the farthest possible extreme from Rousseau's praise of idleness and the dolce far niente. In the next lecture, we'll look more closely at how Franklin deliberately shaped his life and, I think, successfully created a character for himself. We'll also look at Adam Smith, who's remembered today mainly as an economist, but was also a theorist of psychology. And I'll try to show that Smith provides us with an explanatory framework for the way of living that Franklin embodies. So here's the challenge of the autobiography that Franklin worked on intermittently. He never published it or finished it. His testament was his great career, not this book. We'll be trying to locate the inner experience that Franklin doesn't show us. And the reason he doesn't, again, is not that he wants to hide it, though he is very reticent about personal matters, but because his way of thinking about the self makes it pretty much irrelevant. Franklin was a self-made man in every sense of the word, and we'll ponder his account of how he did it.